Castle One. Race officer speaking.
Pressure coming here, pressure coming.
We're a bit lower and faster here. Still gaining on the right line there.
We're looking at 10.5 to 42.
Hello, dear podcast listeners. Thanks again for joining us for another edition of The Pod. I hope you all listened to part one of our sit down with Skip Novak. It's a real treat. There's a short guest appearance in there as well from none other than Simon Le Bon of Duran Duran fame. So if you haven't checked out part one, maybe jump back and give it a go first. It's well worth a listen. In this edition of The Pod, we carry on our chat with Skip. It was so good to sit down face to face with him. He's spent a lot of time in cows over the years, so hopped on over for a quick visit to record the podcast. We sat down at Roark to have our chat, so a big thanks to them for allowing us the time. We pick things up with Skip in this edition, post his Duran Duran drum Whitbread, to discuss his next race, which saw him skipper of the first ever Soviet Union entry. It's at times a tragic tale of a crew racing around the world as their nation back home began to break apart. It's a fascinating account. And we talked to Skip about his love of exploration, his reputation as the go-to man for sailboat-led polar exploration. Again, it's a fascinating account of over 30 years sailing amongst the ice. It's proper, real-life adventure. I hope you enjoy part two of the time I spent with explorer, sailor, legend, Skip Novak.
The next day, literally a suitcase full of cash arrived from London. You know, we need accommodation, we need food, you know, we couldn't feed ourselves. As we were going around the world, the Soviet Union did collapse.
You know, you were still fully motivated to do the next Whitbread, but properly. And I fully get that. I mean, you set out on the funding trail. Talk to me about that time, trying to sell a yacht race to corporate America. I mean, you even approached Dennis Conner. You know, how did all that work out?
Yeah, well, you know, I was convinced that America was sort of ripe for the time, you know, because we had Alaska Eagle. There was more sort of sponsorship and sailing globally, and the Americans must cotton on to this. I figured, you know, it must be time to... So I found a sugar daddy in North Carolina who was a yachtsman who had a string of boats. I think he had a Baltic and a Swan and stuff like that, John. And he funded my fundraising campaign in America. So I sat with him in his office in North Carolina, in Charlotte. And he was a very good investor. You know, he was a CEO of Gillette Razors or something, and he made a ton of money. So he just wanted to do this as a sort of a nice thing to do. And he sort of saw in me somebody who should lead the American campaign, you know, the first really proper American entry. So we sent out again, you know, brochures, database searches to CEOs who sailed, something I'd done, you know, ages ago, with a bit more focus and a bit of cash behind that effort. And we turned up nothing again, you know. And eventually we got to the stage, John had to, you know, commit to the project. So he committed to designing, you know, Bruce Farr designed the boat, started building the boat at Getz Marine in Rhode Island on spec, thinking that we would find the money. So he was that committed and he believed in it that much. But after we got to a certain point, it became evident we weren't going to find the money. And then being a good businessman, he sold the boat and acquired by Roger Nielsen in Sweden, and Magnus, and all that whole Swedish contingent. They bought the boat, which became the Card. You know, it was a far catch. Sort of similar to Fischer Paykel, similar to Steinlager, a bit lighter, less stability, etc. It wasn't the big beast that Steinlager was. So that became the Card. So I was left sort of high and dry. No Whitbread plans. I was building the steel boat at the time, so I was a bit stretched between those two projects, trying to make the pelagic thing happen, you know, cutting steel and grinding steel up in the shed in Southampton, and then I was flying over to America with John And so I probably hadn't spent enough time on either project to make either a really good success, which was a sort of a life lesson for me. And in the end, I sort of gave up hope on the Whitbread because the next one was coming up in 89-90. We had launched Pelagic in 87. It went south for its first year in 87-88. So I'd been to Antarctica. I saw, oh my God, this is amazing. But yet the Whitbread thing was still a thing in your mind. Then, of course, I got a communication. I can't remember how it came, probably a fax in those days by from Vladislav Murnikov in Moscow. You know, something, no idea about this campaign. And he says, yeah, you know, we're already building a boat to do the Whitbread race, and we need you to help us train the crew. That's how that started. I think this was in January or February or something.
And there was lots of rumor, wasn't there, Skip, about a Russian entry for Zizi.
Yeah.
Put it into context for us. I mean, Russia at that time, you know, entering the world sailing stage, how intrigued were you?
Well, I didn't know what to make of it. But of course, the chance to go to Russia at that point in time in history, because this is all pre-perestroika, pre-glasnost, just on the cusp, was like, you know, you got to do it, you know. So I said, look, yeah, I'll be it. Yeah, I'd love to get involved and just check it out and see what's going on. Send me an air ticket. And he said, hey, guys, I can hear them laughing in the background, probably in Moscow, saying, oh, well, in fact, we got a bit of problem with cash, with currency. Can you fly yourself over and we'll reimburse you eventually? And, of course, most people would say, oh, well, forget it. You know, it's a non-starter. And what did I do? I bought myself a ticket. First plane, you know, I had to find out what the hell's going on there. You know, it was amazing. So I spent the first 3-4 days in Moscow at the head office, and they explained the project to me, and they said, well, we're building this boat in Soviet Georgia, in Poti, at the eastern end of the Black Sea. And I said, well, how far along is it? Well, we've got the hull done and this, that, and the other. And I said, well, you know, what about all the other stuff? You know, well, you know, we need to, you know, we're going to probably have to get, things like the rig and the keel and the sails from the West. He says, yeah, for sure. And they said, well, you know, we'd like to get you involved helping us, you know, find this stuff, liaise with these suppliers and train the crew and we get it up and running. I says, well, that's great, but I'd like to see the boat, you know. Well, no, not yet, you know, next trip. So I came back, and so I started nosing around. I started talking to sailmakers and the keelmaker in Germany, Speedwave, and places, and said, you know, I got this project which may go. It sounds interesting. They don't have any money. And they said, oh, yeah, great. You know, there's everybody rolling their eyes. So then the second trip I went over, and I got down there, and they flew me down to the boat, fly to Sukhumi, and then Sukhumi to Poti, and went to the shipyard, and there was the boat sitting there, this, you know, 80-foot hull, bare aluminium, Russian engine inside, and nothing else, you know. And this was now, I think, I don't know, March or something. I can't remember now the date. And I said, how the hell do you expect to get to the start of the Around the World race? You know, first finish the boat here in a place like this and get it around, sail it around, etc. And I said, the only way this is going to happen is if you ship the boat, put it on a ship immediately, you know, somehow, and get it to the UK, and then we'll deal with it there, i.e. try to find sponsorship and the money, generate some interest, and deal with all the suppliers. So they went and they sort of nodded their heads, you know, they had this whole Politburo around there, around the table, and they went off, and then they came back the next morning and said, well, we thought about that, and I think you're right. But we've got a better solution. We're going to fly the boat. And so this is, you know, the story of the Antonov 124, you know, flying the boat to the crew, me, 20-foot sea freight container in there, and, you know, from Sukhumi, Kiev, Moscow, Heathrow. Yeah.
You started the trend, Skip. Now they fly all the America's
companies. Yeah, I read that the other day. There was flying somebody on an Antonov. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I mean, so, once again, a late project, this time really under-resourced, an amateur crew, many of whom, I guess, didn't speak any English.
Oh, yeah.
Were you beginning to wonder, you know, why me? And when they offered you co-skipper, why did you stay? And just how mad was it all?
You know, it's one of those things, it led from crew training to getting involved deeper and deeper and deeper, and eventually the conclusion was co-skipper with Alexei Groshenko, because this is a good marketing ploy to attract sponsors somewhere in the Europe or the States. And so I agreed to all that because I just had to. I didn't know where this was going, but the guys were again a good group of people with all the best intentions, and so I had to let it run out. You know, if it was a disaster, it was a disaster. You know, so but you know, you got to get to the end of the story, and that's why I hung in again. It was just too good a life experience to walk away from. In spite of at every turn, there were good moments to walk away. You know,
I mean, you've got some good friends, Skip. I mean, didn't they say to you, "What the hell are you doing?"
Oh yeah, no, I had all that. Yeah, I had all that, and of course you're working for free, and then you're then not only that, but you're roping in all your friends and suppliers that you've been dealing with for years to start building stuff on spec, hoping they're going to get paid, and you know, and those this wouldn't happen today anyway. But you know, there was a lot of goodwill, and once the Soviets, you know, they arrived in the Hamble, they were loved by everybody because they were all characters, and. They were given an immense support by the community and by everybody involved. Everybody wanted to see this happen, you know. But we, in the end, we didn't get the sponsorship, you know. And of course, that plagued us all the way around the world. You know, we made it, but it was just, you know, hand to mouth the whole way.
Well, you did make the start. I mean, a phenomenal achievement in itself. And what an addition it was, 23 entries on the start line. The first all-women's team, Tracy Edwards, of course, leading maiden. Now that you were actually racing in a massive long leg to Uruguay, I mean, what's your memories of actually racing the boat? Describe what it was like on board for that leg.
Well, again, you know, we did have a sea trial. You know, we went to London, sailed up the Thames for a bit of promo and a bit in the Channel and obviously the Solent. So we had a few miles. The only thing we discovered in that sea trial phase was the keel was wildly too small. Somehow the designer got that wrong. And so we had to put a new keel on the boat at the last, you know, weeks before the start. And we wound up using Rothman's old keel that was in the bushes at HYS. Tony Castro did the modifications to the structure, and we bolted that thing on. I mean, you know, you couldn't make this stuff up, really, nowadays. Anyway, so we got ready, got everything sorted, and I can never forget when we sailed into Southampton, I think it was at the commercial docks down there, by the ferry terminal, actually, where the basin was at the time. And we sailed in, and nobody expected us to make it, because we had bills to pay, all that sort of thing, and we owed everybody, and you know, these guys aren't going to make the start, you know. To pay the bills, I'll never forget, I said, Gladyslav, we're not going to be able to leave. They were still wildly optimistic, and I said, well, you know, if we don't pay these people, like HYS, we owe them a fortune and everybody else, and we can't go. And so he thought about that for a while with the Politburo, and the next day, literally a suitcase full of cash arrived from London. And I was in the porter cabin office at HYS, literally at behind a desk with piles of cash, and there was a line of people outside. I said, well, send in Jim. How much do we owe you, Jim? Jim, get paid. HYS, get paid. And it was like this, cash. Yeah. I think it was like 80,000 pounds or something like that. And so we got the boat ready, and we made our entry into the start basin, and the Russians blew off a couple of huge bomb flares they had. Boom, you know, and that was our sort of, you know, yeah, we're here, guys. So off we went on the first leg, and the sailing was, you know, that was great. I got a friend of mine, Brian Hancock, to do the first leg with us to get a bit of help. There were a lot of guys, good sailors, a lot of guys not very good. Language was a problem. A few spoke perfect English, a few spoke a little at the beginning and were learning, and others never got past anything. So that was difficult. And keep in mind, these were Soviets. Everybody always says Russians. Well, they weren't Russians. We had Russians, but we had Ukrainians, Moldavian, a Latvian, two Georgians. So it was a Soviet team. And of course, if you understand the politics of the time, all those Soviet republics hated each other for all sorts of various reasons. So there was a lot of tension between the team itself that came out around the world from these various characters, you know, from their different political backgrounds, cultural backgrounds. We had all that to contend with, you know. But the sailing, you know, the first leg sailing was great. We did amazingly well. I think we were sixth in that leg or something. And we raced neck and neck with, what was the Italian boat called? Gatorade, you know, on the last couple days, like boat on boat, and we beat them across the line by 100 meters or something. It was fantastic. So we were very pleased in Uruguay. Yeah.
Reading your book, you get a real sense of just how difficult it all was onshore, you know, and obviously sometimes afloat. I mean, the lack of real communication, the lack of money, the political change gaining traction in Russia, the false promises. At the stopover in Uruguay, the skipper of the team, Alexei Grishenko, committed suicide, eventually found hanging from a tree. How did you hear the devastating news, Skip? And, you know, how did it affect you and the rest of the team?
That was the low, obviously the low point of the project. And that, you know, Alexei, if you look, of course, everybody looked back on the whole history with Alexei, and he was the one in charge of building the boat, but he wasn't the best selection to be the Russian or the, you know, the Soviet skipper. There were other people that were better qualified that should have been chosen. So he was a bit uncomfortable in the role from the beginning. And he got marginalized a bit by the crew during the UK stay, myself included probably. He didn't speak a word of English, so he couldn't communicate with the media. So he was really left hung out to dry, I think. And we actually had a Russian psychologist in our team who was there, but she wasn't doing her job, didn't pick up on any of this stuff. And looking back, it was all obvious. Anyway, we sailed down. He decided to go back to Russia, back to Kiev, he was Ukrainian, to see his wife because he had just had a baby who I think he hadn't seen because the baby was born while we were in the UK, so he had all that baggage as well, that, you know, he's got this new family. And he felt, I knew that if he got on that plane and left, he wouldn't come back. And everybody knew that. But in Uruguay, he was actually, when he made that decision, he was very up, happy, bubbly, better than we've ever seen Alexei, you know, during the few weeks we were in Uruguay. And we thought, well, you know, this is a good outcome. You know, yeah, he needs to go home. He needs to see his child, et cetera, et cetera. That, we justified all this. This is logical. And then he didn't show up for breakfast one morning. We had team breakfast and team lunch in various restaurants were, you know, laid on for us. Didn't show up for breakfast, didn't show up for lunch, didn't show up for dinner. And then, of course, the alarm bell started ringing. And I remember I went down to see Admiral Williams, the race director, and I said, we got a situation here that Alexei's, you know, he's disappeared on us, and I'm not sure what to think. So we, you know, called the police. They put out a search for him. And the next day he was found hanging from a tree in the woods in Punta del Este. Yeah. And he obviously was agonizing about, had he made the right decision to leave the project, going back to Kiev, having lost face, leaving this amazing situation. So, yeah, you know, it's like all these things, when this type of thing happens, you look back and it was all there.
The signs were there.
Incredibly sad, yeah. And then, you know, the aftermath of that, you know, we were accused by people in Kiev, you know, from his community and the town and everything of, you know, having orchestrated this whole thing. So they were trying to, you know, impound the boat in Uruguay, not letting us sail because, you know, we decided to continue. We, the crew, we all had a big meeting about it and said, what are we going to do? Are we going to quit because of this catastrophe or are we going to carry on? Of course, they all wanted to carry on. And so you want me to be skipper? I says, fine. So we carried on, but there were powers back home that wanted to scupper the whole thing because they were suspicious of how all this could happen. So we had, it was a dreadful moment. And we had media, you know, from all over the world calling our race office up. And, you know, I'd lost my cool a few times, you know, with some of these interviews about this stuff. And it got pretty hardcore tabloid tactics by the media. And I was trying to, you know, politely explain this, you know, situation. You know, well, you don't know why he committed suicide. You know, it's like all this thing. So it was extremely rough, emotional roller coaster there.
By the Russian media, was it a global story?
No, states, Europe, all over. Yeah. The Russian media was handled by Vladislav, obviously the designer, and I did all the rest. So it was. So off we went. You know, to Fremantle with no money. You know, Uruguay didn't cost us much because we didn't do anything there of substance to the boat. But in Fremantle, we had to do a haul out and various other jobs. So we wound up sailing in that, you know, having left that black cloud of Uruguay behind on the way to Fremantle, 7,000 miles of long leg, Southern Ocean leg. And we know what's going to happen halfway around the world. Are we going to be able to, you know, get through Fremantle? Every port was a challenge to get in and get back out again on the way with debt free and not having, you know, lost anybody in the team or collapsed the project. And to give you an idea of the how this works is that we arrived in Fremantle late that night, finished, didn't do very well on the leg. I was asked to do a Rotary Club breakfast the next morning at 0700. Next, you know, night, you know, I hadn't hardly slept, you know. And so I ended up appealing for help from the Rotary Club in Fremantle. You know, we got this amazing Soviet story and this, that, and the other. We need, you know, we need accommodation. We need food. You know, we couldn't feed ourselves at this point. There was no money. No further funds coming from the Soviet Union and all the rest of it, you know. So, yeah.
I can hear the stress in your voice, even after all this time.
Yeah, we're all sitting around, and I can remember, you know, the Politburo, you know, Mr. Tikhov was the Georgian, he was the, you know, the head of the project, and Vladislav and a few of the other financial guys came down, and as the Russians do, they all sit around in a table in their white jockey shorts, because it was very hot in Fremantle. We're all in this motel room, and they're all eating like slabs of butter, because that's what they do, the Russians, they love that. They just cut a slab of butter off and chuck it down. Or say, well, you know, what are we going to do now? This type of thing. And a couple days later, out of the blue, a friend of mine from Auckland, Paul Smith, showed up in Fremantle because he knew a bunch of us on the race, on other boats. And he said, look, I talked to my friend in New Zealand, Barry Everard, who runs Radio 89 FM, FM radio station. And he wants to buy the project, you know. And he said, gee, well, yeah, that sounds good. So we talked about it with Vladislav, and buy the rights to the project. They'll run a fundraising campaign. They'll take their expenses off, and we get everything else. And the Russians were a bit suspicious of this, you know, how's this going to work? And I said, look, it's our only hope. Just, you know, sign it, and whatever happens, happens, you know. And in the end, that basically got us out of Fremantle, into New Zealand, out of New Zealand, into Lauderdale, out of Lauderdale, and basically back. You know, the money we made, I think we made 400,000 Kiwi through a various incredibly clever fundraising campaign with the Kiwis. We had, they had drop boxes in every pub to support the Soviets, you know. They auctioned off a car. Some guy donated a BMW. They had a fashion show, you know, with all the glitterati of Auckland attending, you know, and this type of thing. And it was amazing, but it was mainly small donations that raised that money. So that was the whirlwind tour. And the Soviets loved it because they were huge celebrities in Auckland. Parties nonstop, and we were all comfortable for the first time in the project. Yeah, so.
Ah, so hand to mouth.
Yeah, we owe a lot to the Kiwis on that one, yeah.
You coaxed that project through the toughest of times, but left them before the final leg. They sailed on their own across the Atlantic. I mean, your work was done. When you look back on that extraordinary project, you know, how pleased are you that you said yes, that you were part of it? You know, it seems in many ways now that it was a lot more than a yacht race.
Oh, it was. I mean, the yachting part of it was a small part, and luckily we had no problems with the boat. Which was a godsend, because if we would have had technical problems with the boat, then the whole thing would have been much more difficult. But the boat was a great boat. The design, barring that keel change, was amazingly seaworthy. I've never felt threatened on it. It was, you know, a submarine, you know, no headroom in the thing. It was quite tough down below, but it was a lovely boat to sail, actually. But it was on the wrong end of the maxi scale. It was the light flyer, totally opposite the Steinlager. So we weren't going to win the race, and we knew that from the beginning. But so the sailing side went well, but did become a small part of the whole equation there. Because, you know, as we were going around the world, the Soviet Union did collapse. You know, and we had three Soviet party members, Communist Party members on the crew, you know. And so these guys were sort of like doing a lot of soul searching, What are we going to come back to? All this sort of stuff when this whole, you know, circus is over with and we get back to the UK. What are they going to do when they come home? Are they going to go home? And the postscript to this whole thing is a few of them went back. Well, they were all married, these people. Most of the crew had married and had children. Very few went back. They all bailed on their families, pretty much. Barring the designer, Viktor Yazykov, he went back. I'm trying to think of who else, but most of them didn't, you know, wound up, you know, in yachting, marine industries in Australia, New Zealand, the States, and Europe. I still bump into them and still in touch with them. And yeah, they just could not face going back to what the Soviet Union was. You know, if they went back to Moscow today, Moscow is amazing. You know, I've been there lately and 4 years ago, and Christ, totally different atmosphere. Everybody's driving around in SUVs and everything, you know, in the big cities anyway, tidied up, rich, wealthy, clean. But back then when I went for it, I saw the old Soviet Union. That's why I feel very privileged to have been there in 89 before that change, to see what Moscow was like then. It was, you know, deserted, fuel clapped out taxis, you know, running around, and that was it. Yeah. So yeah, I look back at that as that was a good one. But what I did learn from that one was how much pressure you could take, because I think I maxed myself out pretty much on that one, you know, compared to the drum one. And yeah, the drum one, I had a lot more backup. You know, I had good sailors, good team. Whereas this one, I was sort of pretty much on my own for a lot of the time, making decisions. You know, and making a lot of decisions against what a lot of the Soviets wanted to do, because I just felt, you know, there's no time to discuss this. We just got to go this direction, you know. So that became an issue as well, you know. not simple. Went down to Antarctica once, South Georgia once, Tierra del Fuego once. I thought, Christ, this place is, there's so much to do. If you go on shore, a fur seal will chase you around. An elephant seal will as well. You're not going to be served. You're going to serve yourself.
Well, a decade later, and you were lured back to racing by the Perron brothers, Bruno and Loic, with Innovation Explorer for the race. I mean, it was such a big deal, wasn't it? Massive state-of-the-art boats, attracting big names, and a huge purse. I think it was $2 million. I mean, massive for the sport. I mean, how exciting was all of that?
Well, that started out slowly. Started out for me in 97 when I was invited by Bruno to do the Transpac race on what was then Commodore Explorer. That was the 80-footer. And we had Florence Artaud, Bruno and I, Cam Lewis from the States, another celebrity, great guy. And we did the Transpac race and broke the record. And then Bruno's plan was to do a circumnavigation of the Pacific to promote the race in 2001. And so, and in the meantime, I think after that race, or maybe before, we had a meeting in Disney Paris, because he brought Disney on board as a sponsor. And so we got all the French sailors together talking about the race. So everybody was in the room and looking forward to this amazing event on maxi multi-hulls. That was Bruno's vision, and he is a visionary. And so Bruno sort of roped me in for very little money again. Because he didn't have a big budget to begin with. And he said, you know, I want you to sail with me as a co-skipper in this Pacific tour to promote the race in places like, you know, well, Tahiti, which was a nice place to go, but it's really hopeless to get any money. And then, so I sailed a boat down to Tahiti with a French crew. We did a bunch of, you know, press thing down there. Left the boat in Raiatea, then Bruno came back the following year and took the boat to Sydney, and was there during the Volvo stopover at that time. Tried to promote the race in Sydney, and then I flew in after that and took with a young crew the boat from Great Barrier Reef up to Yokohama. And one of the crew members we found was none other than Paul Larson, the Speed King. He was a Hobie 16 sailor, you know, hanging around the beach and that type of thing. And he, yeah, we all come. Yeah, it'd be great. So we got Paul on board. That's how he started out. And then, I think five of us sailed the boat, the 80-footer, up to Yokohama. And then we did a refit in Yokohama, and then a bit of promo with the Japanese, trying to get the Japanese involved. Then we sailed the boat across that one summer. That's all one summer now. I think that was 98, 99. Sailed the boat to San Francisco on the Transpac record, North Pacific record, which was originally held by Steve Fawcett. And we broke that in 14 days. Quite easy to break. And then we laid the boat up in San Francisco, and during that winter off-season, and at the same time, in the off-seasons, I was down in Pelagic, obviously. So this worked out great. And four summers, I was on the 80-footer up in the north, sailing around the whole Pacific Basin on a 80-foot cat with no engines, living on the net, boat with no plumbing, completely tanned, black almost, I mean, you know, with a bunch of young guys. It was just marvelous, you know, absolutely fantastic, you know. You know, to go to a loo, you had just a little donut sewn in the back of the net behind the back beam. You just hang on back there, world's biggest B-day, we used to call it, you know. It was great. And so that whole cycle, the last season we did on the promo was I took the boat from San Francisco through the Panama Canal. That's why we put the engines in, to go through the canal, up to New York, did Miami, New York record. Cam Lewis was on board again, and then we did the transatlantic record, which we didn't break. But that was that whole 4-year promo of Bruno trying to get everybody's awareness about this is an amazing event. We need an American entry. We need a Japanese entry. We need so-and-so. And of course, most of that didn't happen. You know, we wound up with a pretty much a French-centric operation there with five boats. You know, Pete Goss was entered, you know, on Innovation, what was called Phillips Innovator, and who, you know, broke up on the way to the start, you know, all that sort of stuff. So it was a very tenuous operation, yeah.
It was an exciting period in the sport, you know, it was full of drama. But, I mean, for you personally, you've gone from sailing around the planet, you know, with a sextant to, you know, hanging on to this giant boat at incredible speeds. When you look back, I mean, it was quite the progression.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and I love the big cats, you know, because it was, you know, I was getting on, actually, in this whole thing, you know. I was almost 50 or something, and, you know, sailing the cat, I found quite comfortable, rather than being heeled over at 15, 20 degrees. You're sailing sort of flat. You're on the net. You know, you want to change jibs. You just let the halyard fly and the jib falls on the net. I mean, it was a new way to sail for me. And I found it, you know, incredibly comfortable, incredibly safe, much safer than a monohull flashing along at, you know, 25 knots. That is today, you know, on the Volvo, 25, 30 knots. And geez, I mean, that is bloody dangerous, in my opinion. Whereas on the multi-hulls, I was very happy. The whole time, yeah.
Skip, in the world of sailing exploration, you've become the real go-to adventurer. How did all that come to be? In 1990, I believe, you established the expedition business Pelagic. Tell us why all that happened.
Well, it actually goes back before that. 88 was my first trip down there, and then that was private expeditions, mountain climbing and sailing. And then 90, we started actually chartering, you know, and that was the, I was a sort of a collection of six boats in Tierra del Fuego in the Beagle Channel, five French and me, you know. You always find these French boats in these odd places, you know, where nobody goes. So it was really a French story down there, and I was the only oddball with Pelagic. And so we started, I saw a niche there. Plus, I had to pay my other two partners off, Chuck Gates and Phil Wade, because we all did our year on Pelagic. That was the concept. And then after the 4 years, I got an extra year because I built the boat. After the 4 years, we had to decide what to do with this thing. So we had a very good plan, either sell, roll over, or one in, two out, two in, one out. You know, it was all designed very well in the beginning. We're still all talking to each other, which is proof in the pudding on that one. I was the only one who wanted to keep the boat because I went down to Antarctica once, South Georgia once, Tierra del Fuego once. I thought, Christ, this place is, there's so much to do. This is like, you know, this is another lifetime for me of exploration and doing what I really wanted to do way back was explore these amazing mountainous areas because mountain climbing is another one of my sort of passions. And so I decided to start chartering to pay them off. And, of course, where do you go when you start a new charter business and you work your contacts? You go back to Chicago, you know, to your old yacht club in Belmont Harbor and get a bunch of old guys who I used to sail with as a kid. They were all now, you know, in their 60s and 70s and get them to charter the boat in the Beagle Channel and go around Cape Horn, you know. So that was that. And I went to New Zealand, same story to my Kiwi mates who helped me with Fazisi. So we got a team from, you know, Barry and Paul and all those guys came and did a trip in the Beagle Channel, and I built on that for the next 10 years with the little boat up to the time we built the big boat in 2002-03.
What makes a good expedition yacht? I mean, describe, I guess, the initial pelagic to us.
Well, I think a good expedition yacht, and I think people are getting tired of hearing me say this over and over in all the things I write and talk about, but it's basically got to be so simple. User-friendly, where the object of the exercise is get to where you're going till you can do what you want to do on shore, whether that's climbing, diving, science, filmmaking, or whatever, and not have the boat as the sort of the object of desire in the first place, where it's, you know, a very precious item and full of accoutrements and conveniences that you probably don't even have in your own home. You know, that's how yachts have developed over the years. I mean, definitely. So my philosophy has always been, you know, simplicity, simple systems, manual sail control systems. Obviously, the boat can only be so big. If you go over that limit, you've got to go push button, electric, hydraulic, on everything. Keep it small. The smaller the better. If I have a choice between sailing my big boat at 74 feet or my little boat at 54, for me to do my own trip, I'd take the little boat every time. Yeah. You know, you can manhandle it. You can, if you get into a situation, you can get out of it. Whereas the big boat, you got to be a bit more careful. And if you go, you know, into a bigger boat, let's say, you know, small super yacht size, you start to really self-limit about what you can do, where you can go, how close you can get to the interesting things, like tying up to the trees, tying up to the rocks, getting close to an iceberg, that type of stuff. You can't do that with a big boat. It's unsafe, and yeah.
That's interesting you say that, because there's more and more super yachts going there all the time.
Yeah. Well, that's a different genre that I'm also involved in with super yachts, and they have a different way to cruise in those sort of places. But that's not my cup of tea. If I'm doing it for myself, I'm more of the hands-on, getting ashore, camping, climbing. That's what I love to do. The boat for me is a taxi. Pure and simple.
You get around, don't you, Skip? I mean, what have been your very best trips?
Best trips on the expedition side is always South Georgia. I would say South Georgia for me has everything, you know, that you could ever imagine as somebody who loves the outdoors and mountainous areas. But it's also, you know, it's good for trekking. There's a lot of free roaming space. Wildlife is so prolific, much more than Tierra del Fuego or the peninsula. You know, the hundreds of thousands of penguins, millions of fur seals, that type of scale, albatross. It's just, and you can walk right up to it. Nothing runs away. Very different from the Arctic, which has been, you know, everything up in the Arctic has been hunted for millennia. It all runs away from you. It's very hard to get close to Arctic wildlife, whereas Antarctic, it's never been hunted, has been hunted in the sealing epochs and whaling epochs, but that's a short-term genetic imprint where now things chase you. You know, if you go on shore, a fur seal will chase you around. An elephant seal will as well. So there's a lot more bang for the buck. It's more of an experiential experience of getting close into the wildlife and doing some great things in the hills as well. You know, there's unclimbed mountains still in South Georgia, which we want to do. So, I haven't done it all. Let's put it that way. That's what I'm trying to say. There's work to be done.
He's away filming this week, but Tim, who produces the podcast, of course, he's upset that he missed you, Skip. I mean, Tim spent a couple of weeks with you filming for the BBC a while back with Sir Robert Knox-Johnston, the great adventurer Sir Ranulph Fiennes, and journalist John Simpson. I mean, that's some crew. What was that trip like? I remember Tim telling me that you were a great diplomat between some big characters.
Oh, that's rare. that was a great trip. I mean, that was it was a short trip. I think we were only down there for, I don't know, 8 or 10 days or something. And I was sort of worried about how it was all going to pan out with these three personalities, plus with the weather. I mean, we needed to get heavy weather to make it, you know, a good story. And, you know, there's a lot of heavy weather around Cape Horn and Tierra del Fuego, but sometimes there's some really nice weather, too, and you don't want that in this situation. But it just was great. And those three guys, the whole object of that exercise was to get them talking to the camera. The sailing thing was sort of an adjunct. It was really getting them talking about how old guys could still be out doing things. And all three of those guys still are. I mean, they're all in their genres are all still incredibly active. And that was the big message of the, you know, that whole top dog story. And I had a great time. I was sort of like a fourth dog, a bit younger, facilitating things in the background. Robin was the, you know, was the skipper of the boat. And his job was to put the other two out of their comfort zone, you know. And that was pretty easy to achieve. Because Randall Fiennes got deathly seasick. John launched a winch handle over the side. All sorts of things happened. But it was a lovely conversation and interaction between the three of them. And it worked very well. And I would have to say, if you've seen the other two episodes, I think that Cape Horn one was the best one. You know, we did everything we were supposed to do. We went out, we went around the Horn, we drank whiskey at the Cape Horn Lighthouse, smoked cigars. You know, it was a great, love. I have fond memories of that, and I'm in touch with all three of them, and still, we still talk about another trip together, but now we're, you know, me included, are all getting that much older, so I'm not sure that's going to happen.
Well, we're great fans of Sir Robin on the podcast. I mean, yeah. He still thinks he's 35, so I'm sure he'd be up for anything.
Absolutely, there you go. Good on him.
You've done a lot of trips with Stephen Venables, the climber. Mm. What sort of expeditions do you guys go off on? I mean, that's some real adventuring. What sort of thing do you get up to with a boat full of climbers or skiers?
Well, there's sort of two different groups of that. One, we take people, one of the favorite ones is the Shackleton route on South Georgia. I've done that five times, I think three times with Stephen now. And between the two of us, we sort of, through his marketing and my marketing, we get the group together. Everybody has to have reasonable experience on skis, winter camping. And if they don't, Stephen takes them to the Alps and sets them up. You know, so we have a whole sort of system of how to get everybody to the point of being able to do the Shackleton route. And that's sort of more amateurs being led by us. And then the other side is getting really good climbers where we're part of a good climbing team and do something much more ambitious. So we've done a bunch of these southern traverses from the south tip of South Georgia up to the central section. You know, we've done 16-day ski traverses and 12-day ski traverses, trying to climb technical mountains on the way. Sometimes successful, usually not successful because of the weather in South Georgia. So pretty abysmal that, you know, if you get a window of opportunity, it's rare. But we love it because it's so challenging. And you're there on the island, you're the only ones on the island doing that. There's nobody else. Maybe the odd ship on the coast, cruise ship, maybe we go early in the year. There's nobody there. So the whole thing is an amazing experience. I mean, it really is what we call exploratory mountaineering, which is my favorite thing to do.
It sounds amazing. You know, Skip, I look at your website every year. Mm. Think, how am I going to do one of those trips?
You must join us.
I must. I say that. I say that every time.
I know Tim would love to go.
I mean, I'm guessing you can't just buy a boat and start touring places like Antarctica. How tightly controlled is it? And what sort of permits and permissions does one need to run a business guiding in those areas?
Now it's very controlled. When I first started way back, there was nobody to ask, no permits. You could pretty much do anything you wanted to do. Not that we ever did anything that wasn't really environmentally unpalatable. We did shoot a few seals and eat them, you know, in the early days. If you did that now, you'd be hauled up before the Foreign Office. Illegal. British law. So nowadays, it's highly regulated. We work through the Foreign Office to get our Antarctic permit. For South Georgia, you work through the South Georgia government because that's UK sovereign territory, whereas in the Antarctic context, the Foreign Office manage the British membership of the Antarctic Treaty. So every national ship, airplane, or expedition has to get a permit. I mean, that's absolutely essential. And some of these things are written in law of some countries, some not yet. It's all been ratified, but other countries are a bit more, you know, go ahead about actually getting it in statute, which is the case of the UK, case of the States, France, Scandinavian countries. Some countries haven't gotten around to it yet. But that's, yeah. And the other thing is we're a member of the International Antarctic Association of Tour Operators, which is a self-regulatory body, which every cruise ship is a member, not all, but most of the yachts operating down south. And we basically set our own rules in conjunction with the Antarctic Treaty, working in tandem to make sure they're happy, to make sure we're happy and we have a set of rules that's usable and not draconian. And that's been very successful. What is a problem going forward is the sheer numbers of yachts and ships in the Antarctic, especially South Georgia, less so, but it's exploded pre-COVID. I mean, last year we had 75,000 visitors. When I started in 1988, we had, I think, 1,000 visitors to the Antarctic. And it's ramped up. It ramped up very steeply, steadily, up to 2008 crash, and then it softened, and then it's been ramping up even more steeply up until this year. And a lot of companies building more ships who've been caught out with their pants down big time now with this COVID thing. There was a lot of ships in build or already launched from big companies. I'm talking Quark Expeditions, Hurtigruten in Norway, Silver Sea, you know, big players, and a lot of small players who will go bust. So it's good for Antarctica to give it a bit of a rest, but the whole business model for cruise ship tourism, I would say, is very uncertain, if not collapsed. For yachts, probably we're in a better position being small. Small is better, being able to adjust to this new normal. I think we can duck and dive around, you know, take people down, film teams, etc., who will be willing to quarantine, who will be able to do this, that, and the other. But, you know, with a cruise ship of 200 packs or 400 packs, it's unmanageable to get them through the gateways onto a ship to Antarctica safely back again. So, yeah, that whole thing is, it's all change.
I mean, by now, Skip, you spent a lot of time down there around the ice. What changes, if any, have you seen down there? I mean, is the environment visibly changing at all in the deep south in Antarctica?
Yeah. I've been there over 30 years, and we see, you know, pretty massive change of features. For example, glacial recession, glacial downwasting, shorelines appearing where it was an ice front before. Yeah, that's a given. You know, that is known. We've got all the pictures to prove it and all the rest of it. The big change, I think, what affects our operation is probably temperature. It's a couple degrees warmer than it was 30 years ago, degree and a half or two maybe. Not always, but generally there's more temperatures above zero when you're down there than there were below zero. It's better to be below because everything's frozen. You're not snowing as opposed to raining, which is much more pleasant, number one, if you're in the mountains especially. A lot more glacial runoff. Water pouring off the glaciers. Yeah, so that's, I mean, the climate change is evident. And then, of course, you have the different, the reactions of the wildlife to climate change and different ice patterns. Some penguins, like Gentoos, are doing well. Their numbers going up because as the ice retreats, less sea ice means more open ground for them to nest. They are moving south and increasing in numbers. Their habitat is increasing, in effect, whereas the other more Antarctic species like adelies and chinstraps are sort of collapsing, going down due to loss of sea ice because they feed on krill. The krill feed on diatoms and little creatures underneath the sea ice. So the less sea ice you have, the less food for the krill to eat. There's less krill, the penguins suffer. So there's winners and losers in all that game down there. Generally more losers than winners. Yeah.
How concerned are you about what you've seen?
Well, very concerned. We're all concerned. And the same thing in the Arctic. You know, we've been up to the Arctic a few years. I've got less experience up in the Arctic. But, you know, the dramatic difference of Arctic sea ice every summer is just unbelievable. But, you know, what can we do about it as operators? Not much. We still take people down there. It's still a marvelous place to go. And part of our thing with the Tour Operators Association is educating people. You know, it's not just taking people down to have fun or adventure. Everything has an educational part to it now. Even though we don't have formal lectures on my boat because the boat's too small for that, or the ships do. But we have all the books. We talk about it a lot. So people do come away with a better sort of awareness of what's happening down there than if they hadn't been. And I think for me, that's a big, you know, pleasure for me to be able to facilitate these voyages to so many people, to bring them down and show them these places. And they come away with, I think, definitely a bit better understanding of global environment, if you will, no doubt.
You've had an incredible career, Skip. I mean, you've run a business that shows people an amazing part of our planet. And you were there in the early days of real professional offshore racing. Do you miss the competition, the race? Do you miss all of that?
Yeah, I definitely miss the racing once you leave the dock. I love that. I love the sailing and all the rest of it. But I was, even though I performed well for the audience, let's put it that way. I did a lot of writing about it and all that because we had to do that. As the circus ramped up around sailing, I sort of got turned off by it a bit and wouldn't want to participate in that sort of environment the way it is now. Wouldn't feel comfortable, really, for some, not sure why, but yeah, it's not me. Not me anymore. But, you know, if somebody offered me to go, you know, race across an ocean now without, you know, any frills attached, or yeah, I'd go, sure. But, you know, I'm so busy now, to carve out time to go racing, it's very difficult. I'm flat out.
Too much to do. Skip, we've had a lot of people on the podcast now. And one of the things we love about making this is the real diversity of disciplines, of type of sailing, from Olympians to offshore, the America's Cup, of course, the early pioneers. But I can't think that any of our guests are just so associated with something in the way that you are. Even the name Skip Novak conjures up this feeling of adventure, of exploration. I mean, that's a pretty cool legacy to leave.
I'm happy with it.
When you look back on all you've done, what are you most proud of, Skip? What do you see as your greatest achievement?
I think what I mentioned before, I think looking at net value for what I've done in my sort of peripatetic and wayward life, I think it's actually bringing people down to the Antarctic, facilitating their wishes and desires to visit these places and doing it in a manner, small scale, small yacht, where they can really come away saying that they've been on an expedition, they understand better what Antarctica is all about, or South Georgia, and have participated in that expedition. Because the way we run our show is, you know, everybody comes on board, we're all one team, the skipper and the guests, everybody together. We all eat at the same table. It's not a classic charter situation. And we wouldn't be able to do a lot of these trips without the participation of the guests. They help us sail the boat, they help us launch the dinghy, they cook, they wash up, and that's been our philosophy from the beginning, which I think has been very successful. And I mean, you know, the proof is we have so many repeat clients. You know, they've been to Antarctica, now they want to go to South Georgia, then they want to go to the Falklands, then they want to go to Tierra del Fuego. So I think it's been a great formula. Not too many boats do it. Most of the other boats have a more of a classic approach. So we're sort of, you know, in our own little niche there. And that's why we promote it. We explain it very well to the clients. It's not, you're not going to be served. You're going to serve yourself. Yeah.
Skip Novak, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
How good does all that sound? Setting off for South Georgia in the footsteps of Shackleton. What an adventure. Skip's had a remarkable life. If you like what you've heard, his books are a great read. He's such a good communicator. To Skip, many, many thanks for coming on the podcast. I could sit and chat all day. If you have enjoyed this edition, please let us know. Like, maybe write a review and subscribe on whatever platform you're joining us on, or just send me a message. I'm easy to find. Shirley Sale on Twitter and Instagram, or just me everywhere else. It's always great to hear from you all. We do read and think about what you've got to say about the pod. Thanks again to Tim at Vertigo Films for editing this edition of the podcast. As ever, great work, Tim. And to our friends at Rourke and Cowes, many, many thanks for letting us sit down for a chat with Skip. Thank you. Next month, well, as I've said at the start of these two podcasts, we are now down in Auckland. We'll both be working on the America's Cup, and with all four teams about to hit the race course in a pre-Christmas World Series style event, by the beginning of January, we should have a pretty good idea of how they're all performing. So if you like fast boats up on foils, next month could well be for you. That's all from us until next time. Thank you so much for listening and sail safe, everyone.
This is Castle One standing by. Out.